Welcome or welcome back to Horse for Horror. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week we are doing Murdered.
Okay, I'm going to go first this week. And my case is the murder of Michelle Martinko. You heard of it?
I haven't.
Ooh, good. Okay. So it was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Iowa? Oh. What are they doing out there with those potatoes?
Isn't that Idaho?
My case is in Idaho.
All right, so a little bit of background. So Michelle actually had an older sister, and her mother had 5 miscarriages before she conceived Michelle. So it was really difficult for them to get Michelle.
Yeah, so I'm sure Michelle is their baby.
Yeah, and she was the youngest, so...
Oh, that's sad.
Early on, Michelle was diagnosed with scoliosis, so she had to wear a back brace. And of course, she felt awkward and like she wasn't the same as everybody else, all that, because she had to wear this. But at the age of 14, she was able to remove the brace, and at this point, this is when she started dating and like everything changed for her.
Oh, good for her.
And so let me paint you a little picture. She was like this cute, petite, blonde, and at the time, the Farrah Fawcett hair was in, so she was doing the Farrah Fawcett hair.
Oh.
She was very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Her first boyfriend, she met him at the age of 15. His name was Andy Seidel, I think is how you say it. And they dated for 2 years, but then they broke up because Michelle didn't want to be in a committed relationship.
That's a long time, especially when you're, like, children.
Yeah. But apparently, Andy did not take this too well and started keeping tabs on Michelle. He had to know who she was dating, where she was going, blah, blah, blah. Okay?
Toxic masculinity.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So, this murder occurred December 19th, 1979.
Oh, oldie. Mm-hmm. She vintage.
Why did say Farrah Fawcett hair?
That's true. Very vintage.
She was reported missing at 2 a.m. on December 20th, 1979. So, basically, she went out to the mall, and she had, like, $100-something in cash, and she was going to go pay off this coat that her mom put on layaway for her for Christmas.
Aww.
So that's why she was at the mall. The Westdale Mall, if anyone was curious. And she ended up deciding not to get the coat, and then she took that money and she bought, like, other various things, and she still had, like, a little cash left over. But at 4 a.m. on December 20th, her body was found in the front seat of the family's Buick in the parking lot of the Westdale Mall. She was...
Oh, my God, that's so close to Christmas, too.
But she was parked, like, way out.
Aww.
She wasn't parked close.
In the front seat, dude? Oh, my God.
The passenger seat. The front passenger seat.
That's weird. Mm.
So she was 18 years old at the time of her murder, and she was in her final year of high school.
Oh, that's so sad. What the fuck?
So the police ruled out that, well, they didn't rule anything out. They weren't sure why this happened, but it wasn't a robbery. She still had the cash in her hand, or on her person. And the items that she bought were still in the car. So nothing was taken like that. There was no evidence of sexual assault. So they kind of thought initially maybe it was supposed to be a sexual assault or a robbery. And then, like, it never happened. And she just ended up getting murdered. So it's important to note that she put up a hell of a fight. She had defensive wounds all over her arms and hands and, like, her body. So they...
Good, but also so sad.
Yeah. They're, like... Their theory was that it was an initial motive of something else, and then she fought really hard, and it, like, deterred him from doing anything. Like, kind of derailed.
Yeah, and the person...
Yeah.
Yeah, derailed the whole situation, and then the person was like, well, I have to kill her.
Yeah.
Or you could have just been a good human being and left her alone,
stalker.
Yeah, maybe,
like, leave her alone.
Yeah.
So, she had actually run into both her ex-boyfriend, Andy Seidel, and a male friend named Tracy at the mall that night. And her friend, when he talked to her, she mentioned that she felt like she was being followed or watched. And then they went on their merry way, and he noted that she had parked really far off when it was dark. And he's like, see ya!
And he wasn't like, let me walk you. Okay, so did she meet, were Tracy and Andy there together?
No, separately.
Okay.
Separately. Okay. She just ran into them separately.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
But, I mean, Andy wanted to know where she was, so he could have just been, like, following her.
Yeah.
That's just an opinion, I don't know.
Pure speculation.
Absolutely. So, she was stabbed 29 times, mostly to her face and chest.
Oh my god!
She fought back so hard, she actually caused the killer to cut himself and leave blood evidence behind.
Good.
The fatal stab wound was to the heart, causing Michelle to bleed to death, according to an autopsy report.
Oh.
There was blood evidence found on her dress and the gear shifter and the outside of the door. Wait, sorry. There were rubber glove impressions on the outside of the door.
Oh, okay.
There were also other evidence of rubber glove impressions left at the scene. So we don't have any fingerprints. The only thing we have is this, like, little bit of blood evidence on her dress and the gear shifter. And the gear shifter back then was, like, the tree behind the steering wheel.
Oh, yeah. My first car had that.
Yeah. So years later, DNA was tested against the profile found at the scene, and all known males that had a connection with Michelle were eliminated as suspects.
Even Andy?
Andy, yes. So for 27 years at that point, he lived with everyone thinking that he had killed Michelle.
I mean, let's be honest. I thought he killed Michelle this whole time. I was like, easy case, Kayla. Andy did it.
But he did not. He actually just really loved the girl and just couldn't let her go, but was not the stabby stalker type. He was the I don't even think he was a stalker, but you know,
that'll teach me to judge.
Yeah, and Michelle's parents actually died, most likely believing that Andy killed her.
Damn, that's fucked up. That's really sad.
Yeah, so they ended up putting the DNA into CODIS and it pulled no hits.
Oh,
which only means that they didn't have somebody in their system. So, they decided what they were going to do is a couple different things. So, have you heard of a DNA snapshot?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't know how, like, scientifically accurate this is, but they basically take the DNA. I don't know what all they do to it, but they claim that they can determine eye, skin, hair color, potential ethnicity from a DNA sample, like the profile, and give you a portrait of what this person most likely looks like.
Oh, that's cool. I wonder, is that accurate? Like,
I don't know, but in this case, it was.
Okay, good.
I'm going to pause here because I'm going to show you some pictures.
Okay. Oh my, she is really pretty.
Yeah.
Oh, her eyes are so gorgeous.
Yeah. And then the second one is the snapshot.
The second one. Oh, whoa. It all looks like the same guy, just old.
Yeah, so going back, the DNA snapshot was created, and I showed you those pictures. So they weren't sure how the person would wear his hair. And then you can also see underneath it says, like, skin color is fair or very fair, and it's at a 74.3% confidence. And then it gives you confidence for eye color, hair color, and, like, freckles or no freckles.
Whoa. Mine would say freckles.
Confirmed. So this is what they just did, three different ones because they weren't sure, like, the like, I guess, personal style the person would have.
Yeah.
So they had that, and then the police decided to go into genealogical testing.
Mm.
They eventually found a distant match that came up as a Brandy Jennings of Vancouver, Washington. She ended up being, like, some distant cousin, like, twice removed or something like that. I don't know. So they found her, and then they started mapping her family tree. And eventually, this mapping led to three brothers in Iowa. So from
this mine has some of this.
Really?
Yeah, like the family DNA testing. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. We're pretty good at this. So police decided they can't talk to the three brothers because if they tell one of them, they think one of them is guilty. They're all going to, like, clam up.
And oh, run. Yeah.
So they decided to go undercover, follow each of the three brothers, and then attempt to get DNA samples from them.
Discarded DNA. Yeah.
So two of the three brothers were eliminated. The final brother came back as an exact match to the DNA profile from the crime scene. If I remember correctly, it was a 99.9999994% match. It was ridiculous. Oh,
my God.
And it basically ruled out, like, any other male. It's like a one in, I don't know, the statistic was, like, one in, like, some crazy, like, million number.
Yeah.
And we don't even have that many people, like, on the planet.
That's wild.
So they were like, oh, yeah, this is him.
That's awesome.
So they had their suspect. Now I'm going to show you their suspect compared to the snapshot.
Okay. Here we go. Okay. Oh, wow. It definitely looks like the old person.
Yeah, like, look at the nose and, like,
is even his, like, chin and the, like, lines around his mouth.
So look at, go back to the, so look at the picture of the younger suspect and then go back to the, okay, I sent you, here, let me send you this too. Because here's the three. Look at the far left. The far left on the snapshot looks almost exactly like this guy when he was younger.
Wow. Wow, this is good.
Yeah. So,
even more photos of her. She's so beautiful.
The DNA snapshot photo was compared to the younger photo of the suspect. His name is Jerry Burns, and it looks pretty similar, as we discussed. So I want to put this on Instagram so everyone can see it.
Okay, yeah.
So Jerry Burns was a married father of three, possibly two, I can't remember, and had no criminal history.
How do you just, like, murder someone and then go on with your life?
Well,
this is what really fucks me up about, like, the Golden State Killer, you know? Yeah.
When he had raped kids and murdered at the all time. These people.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the guy had kids at the time he murdered her?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How do you live your life, dude?
No idea. On December 19th, 2018, 39 years to the day after Michelle's murder, the lead investigator decided to question Jerry Burns. He wanted to try to shake him up.
Hell yeah.
There was, like, a hidden camera and a coffee cup, etc. I don't know. But apparently, Jerry just, like, denied any involvement during the interview, but then went on to say something really odd. Like, he was being questioned about the murder of this girl 39 years ago. And his, you know, they were telling him, like, your DNA's here. Like, what's going on? Why don't you tell me what's going on? And then
he just
oddly decided to bring up the missing reporter, the girl who went missing outside of, like, her home on her way to work in 1995, Jody Huzentruitt.
Okay.
So that one's still unsolved. Nobody found her. She's just been missing since 1995. And she worked in Mason City, Iowa, which is just 2 hours from where Burns lived at the time. So he's being questioned about this murder of a young blonde girl in a parking lot from 1979, and he just randomly goes, remember that girl that disappeared in 1995?
Uh-huh.
That's it.
What are you
doing?
What a fucking weirdo. Yeah, what are you... This is not a good look, sweetie.
So yeah, now there's speculation that he possibly had something to do with her disappearance, and they think that maybe Michelle wasn't his only victim.
Oh. I'd say that's a pretty brutal way to murder someone. That's probably not his first merry-go-round, especially since he wore gloves and everything.
Yeah, like he knew very well what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he only got caught because he got cut.
Mm-hmm. Because she fucked him up.
Yeah. So I don't know what they're going to do about the missing Jody case.
Jody? Yeah.
But it's another high-profile one. I almost covered it before, but I was like, no, let's wait.
Well, we have an unsolved episode scheduled.
I kind of hope that, like, he's the one that did it and they are able to prove it soon.
Yeah, me too.
But who knows? It's just speculation at this point. Jerry Burns was arrested due to the DNA profile match. That's the only evidence they had, and he went on trial February of 2020.
Wow.
Yeah. Due to the high nature of the case, the trial was moved an hour away to Davenport, Iowa. And then on February 24th, 2020, a jury deliberated for 3 hours and found Burns guilty of first-degree murder at the age of 60.
Dang. Dude, season of justice, no matter how old you are, no matter where you run, we're going to fucking get you.
Yeah. Especially DNA.
Like, as we should.
The further that DNA progresses, like, you're not going to be able to get away with shit.
Yeah. Which makes me very happy.
Yeah. But it also kind of makes me nervous because I want to make sure that we do it right and we're not like...
It is a slippery slope.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in my case.
Oh, okay. Yay. So, Jerry pleaded not guilty, and to this day, he still claims that he is innocent. And he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
See ya.
So, Burns' defense gave no alibi for him the night of the murder, confirmed that DNA was, in fact, Jerry Burns' DNA, but stated that the reason it was most likely in the car is because Jerry may have been at the mall the night before the murder, and that he may have eaten at the food court that Michelle may have eaten at, and it may have been transferred from the food court to Jerry. Or, like, from Jerry to the food court and then to Michelle, I'm sorry. Yeah.
His blood?
Yeah. His blood DNA, or, like, his DNA. So,
no, honey.
Now, cool. Is this enough reasonable doubt? No.
No.
And here's another reason why it's not enough reasonable doubt. Every single male that had come into contact with her, including Andy, including Tracy, were tested. And they 100% met her that night, and their DNA was not in the car.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where you're getting the transfer theory, but good job. Nice try.
Yeah, that's not enough.
So the prosecution disagreed with the defense with their ridiculous argument, saying that Michelle had come into contact with multiple people at the mall that night and none of their DNA had transferred to the crime scene. They also stated that there was only one way Jerry Burns' DNA could get in the car, and that was if he was in fact in the car that night.
Yeah, so why and were they you pulled there, his Jerry? DNA. And they pulled his DNA from his blood, right? Yeah, bro, she didn't get blood on herself, get in the passenger seat, and then go, oh shit, whose is this, and wipe it on her car.
So
like,
their theory
no.
is, too, because those rubber glove impressions on the outside of the car were on the driver's side. So their theory is she got in the car, and then someone, like, came up on her, startled her, got in the driver's seat, and pushed her over to the passenger seat, and then murdered her.
Yeah.
That's their theory.
I wish that he would just confess and tell us what happened that night. Give someone some closure.
His kids do not believe that he did it.
How do you... Okay, I'm sorry. No matter... Kayla, if your DNA... If your blood was found at the scene of a crime, I'd be like, you should probably fucking did it.
I get why they would think that. Because to them, their dad is a saint, obviously. Everyone's dad is a saint to them. But... He has no criminal record. He literally has the perfect history, right? And then, so they want to believe that someone messed up, which I understand. No.
I understand, but when you confront reality and facts.
Yeah, well, when you look at it and you go, there's no way his DNA got in that car.
Unless he was there.
And then combined with the fact that it's 9.99 whatever percent his, and combined with the fact that it's a 1 in whatever million chance.
Yeah.
And we have less than that many people on the planet. Like, it's him.
Yeah. I am a firm, firm believer in DNA. It'd be different if his DNA was pulled from, like, oh, here's a fingerprint that matches his. No, it's literally pulled from blood within the vehicle. Yeah. It's, baby, it's your daddy, okay? Yeah.
And that's the thing. They took the DNA profile from the crime scene, and they matched it with DNA they got from his discarded straw. So, like, they compared the two.
It's your daddy.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to tell you. It sucks. Your father's a horrible human. You didn't experience that, but what can you do, you know?
But I think that's probably the reason why he's not confessing is because he has to maintain his image for his kids. So, while Burns was in jail, he actually made a few curious comments to another inmate, and one of them was, like, kind of concerning to a level or to a degree that the inmate decided to come forward voluntarily and testify against him. Because there were a few cases. Well, the guy had asked Burns if he had done it, and he just said, I can't talk about this. Which, that's a normal comment. I think there was more to it.
Well, first of all, I would say, no, they got the wrong guy.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not like out of the ordinary enough to be like, oh, he did it. Like,
yeah.
You know? So, yeah, there's that. And then the one that made him step forward is they were playing some kind of game or gambling or something to that along those lines. And Jerry got mad because he was losing. And then he made a comment that said something along the lines of, you better stop or I'll have to take you to the mall.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
So, you could be joking about it because you're in an unfortunate circumstance if you are, in fact, innocent.
Innocent. But...
but...
you shouldn't joke about that if you're innocent.
It's like so far disconnected from what you should say. And I don't want to say that because we shouldn't judge people off of, like, random comments that they try to make. Because, like, I know when people try to, like, or make me go on the defensive and I haven't done anything wrong, I go, like, all sarcastic about it, you know? So maybe that
And I've made stupid comments before, but I've also never been, like, it was convicted, like, of a crime. Yeah,
very creative the way that he said it. And that makes you think that he's, like, he thinks he can get away with it.
And I'm sure he, like, said it in a way that the inmate was, like, what? And I think it's really telling, too, that the inmate came forward voluntarily. Like, it wasn't like, hey, we offered him this deal, and then he told us his comment. Yeah. It was, no, he approached us.
Yeah. I don't know anything further about that. Then again, that's just information that you guys can have. Not used to convict him, but...
just so you know.
Yeah, just to, like, really sell it. So, fun fact, and then I'm done with my case. It was a little bit shorter. Burns has appealed the conviction and retained Kathleen Zellner. Do you know who she is?
No.
She is the attorney who represented Stephen Avery in Netflix's Making a Murderer.
Oh. Huh.
Is that telling?
Probably. Mm. I think it is. I'll keep my opinions on that case to myself.
So we might have another Making a Murderer season.
Yeah.
And that was a good case. Like, an exonerated coming up.
If he gets exonerated, I'll lose my mind.
Okay, well, that is it for the murder of Michelle Martinko.
That was a good case. I really liked it.
Yeah.
I liked that he was caught.
Yeah, same. And recently.
Yeah, get him, dude. My person was caught recently, too.
Sweet. Hey, yeah, we were just... same wavelength.
Bam! That's why we're BFFs, yo. Okay.
Okay.
So my case this week is the murder of Angie Dodge.
Okay. I think I've heard of her name before.
Oh, I want to show you a photo of her.
Okay.
Okay, that's Angie.
Aw, she's cute.
Yeah, her smile is so big. She looks so good.
Yeah.
All right. So Angie was born, I wrote, was born on, but she was born on December 21st, 1977. So mine is vintage too. Well, I guess that's when she was born, not when she was murdered.
Yeah.
In Vancouver, Washington, but her family...
Vancouver?
Yeah!
Oh my god!
But her family later moved to Idaho Falls, Idaho.
Idaho Falls, Cedar Rapids, oh my god.
I know. Also, Angie was the youngest of four children.
What is this?
To her parents, Jack and Carol, and she was the only daughter. So by all accounts, Angie was an extremely bright and gifted child. Her family was really active when they were growing up, so they would often take these like extravagant camping trips into the middle of nowhere, and they just like bond, have a really great time, and they just enjoyed doing that kind of stuff. Can't relate, but I appreciate it.
That's amazing. Growing up, we went camping like that. Not like super remote when we went with like my parents' friends, but it was really fun. It was really fun.
Yeah, we camped a lot too, and I was young, and I have a lot of really great memories. Oh, we used to go to the same place. It's called Ho Hum on the Niangua River, and there's like this trail in the woods that you can walk like a mile up with your tubes, and then the river will float you down to our campsite. And so I remember when we were young, we would just do that for hours. And I look back, I'm like, oh my god, someone could have like taken us, or we could have, you know, gotten bit by a snake or drowned in the river, but nope.
Oh yeah.
I look back, I'm like, what the fuck? But okay. So Angie was also said to have loved Christmas, which is, you know, kind of strange because her birthday's on December 21st, and I would have been a total fucking bitch about that if I was a kid. But yeah. I would have been a monster. But Angie wasn't like me, and she loved it so much that her family would throw a combined birthday and holiday party together. Do you guys
do that for me, since my birthday is, like, so close to Thanksgiving?
Oh, I would be a little bitch if that was me. My birthday is not now.
It was great because I would guilt trip my entire family into coming because I'm like, it's not just Thanksgiving, it's my birthday. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll be there.
Oh, yeah, I guess it is about you as well.
Sure is. You know what I want to eat? Red velvet cake. Let's go.
And presents. But every year, Angie would make what her family called the, quote, special Christmas necklaces for everybody. And so they were made out of bells and ribbon. But she would always make extra in case some of her family members brought, like, extra guests that she didn't know about. So she's just, like, an awesome kid, you know?
She's very thoughtful.
Yeah. When Angie was in high school, she tutored other students in both math and English. She graduated in 1995 with honors and briefly attended classes at ISU.
Dang.
So Angie and her mother, Carol, were said to be very close, so it was pretty difficult for both of them when Angie moved into her own apartment when she was 18. Angie had been working at a local beauty shop, which you can tell in her photos because she's obviously a beauty queen.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd saved up all of her money to move, as well as buy herself a brand new car. So she's like out there doing it, being successful. On June 12th, 1996, Angie'd stopped by her family home around like 9 p.m. that night and was just hanging out with everyone. Her and her mom were talking, and she was telling her how excited she was to be living on her own, but also that being an adult was, like, kind of difficult, and it was harder than she thought it was gonna be, which, like, same.
Yeah, it's an adjustment.
It's very different than what I thought.
I want to be so independent, but at the same time, I want to be really dependent on
you. Yeah, I'm like, I don't need you to cook this mac and cheese, but also I don't know how. So if you could. Like, seriously, though, thank God for Steven, because if he wasn't here, I would genuinely eat, like, spaghetti, because it's one of the only meals I know how to cook, and takeout.
Do you know how amazed I was when I realized there are cooking directions on the back of boxes?
Yes.
When I was younger.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, I can do this.
It just tells you how to do this. And this is all from Carol's account, like this last night. So she said that while they were chatting and Angie was talking about her struggles, she reached out and she hugged her baby. And they stayed like that for like 5 minutes. And during this time, Carol told Angie that Angie would always be her baby no matter what she did and that she loved her.
Well, yeah, that's pretty standard.
Like, yeah. But so mom sweet. To daughter. Yeah. Angie left the house that night around 10:20 p.m. and Carol described her leaving as like a slow motion movie scene. And the last thing that they ever said to each other was, "I love you," not knowing that it would be their final moments together.
Aw.
Yeah.
That's sweet, though.
Yeah, that's like, you know, the best. You know, you obviously don't want someone to be murdered, but that's like the best last interaction you have with the victim.
Yeah.
And definitely. So that's like the last memory that she will always have.
Yeah, it's peaceful for yeah. her. So that's nice.
So the next morning on June 13th, 1996, Angie was a no-show at work. And so some of her coworkers were obviously worried because this wasn't like Angie at all. And they went over to her apartment to check in on her. And that's when they discovered their friend and coworker had been brutally murdered in a violent attack.
In her apartment?
In her own apartment, yeah.
Dang.
Officers arrived shortly after and began to process the scene. It appeared that Angie had been sexually assaulted, stabbed 14 times, and her throat had been cut so deep that she was nearly decapitated.
Oh my, how do you do that? How do you do
that? So much rage. Like, I can't even, like, I don't know, rip a band-aid off of Steven because it, like, pulls his hair and he's like, ow! So I couldn't imagine stabbing someone. It's just, I can't do that, so I'm like, how the fuck can someone else do that?
Do you have to, like, seriously disassociate, I think?
Yeah. There were no immediate signs of rape, but police noted that her clothing was halfway off and semen was on her body, so they obviously, like, came to that conclusion.
Great.
Angie had many defensive wounds, indicating that she'd put up a massive fight against her attacker and was, you know, fighting for her life.
Yeah.
Angie's boyfriend at the time was out of town for the days leading up to and after Angie's murder, so he was, like, immediately cleared as a suspect.
Yeah.
The investigators were able to pull a complete DNA profile from the semen, as well as multiple hairs that were left at the scene.
That's what you fucking get, idiot.
I know.
That's what you get. First of all, don't murder somebody, but also if you're gonna be so fucking crass to, like,
just leave your DNA.
Yeah, you're an idiot. Yeah. And that's what you fucking get. Your dick got you in trouble. You're welcome.
Normally it does. So the police obviously took this DNA profile. They put it into their system, CODIS, but they didn't get any hits.
Dang.
So from there, the police obviously started investigating and gathering DNA samples from suspects in town, so like sexual offenders, violent offenders, as well as from individuals that Angie knew or had a connection with, but again, none of them were a match. So the case began to grow cold in the following months, and any hope of finding this murderer started to, you know, wane. But then, on January 6th, 1997, an acquaintance of Angie's named Ben Hobbs was arrested in Nevada on charges of sexually assaulting a woman at knife point. Obviously, due to the similarity and type of the crime committed, officers believed that Ben could be the suspect they're looking for, and they began to investigate him.
Okay.
So while Ben was being held in Nevada, the police began to interview his friends and family in hopes that one of them would be able to, like, implicate him in Angie's murder and say, yeah, he was in Idaho Falls the night she was murdered.
Right.
One of those friends was named Christopher Tapp, who was 20 years old at the time. Chris had what some people might call a, quote, questionable past, but really Christopher was just involved with drugs when he was younger.
Okay.
So his life started out pretty typical. His parents, you know, he had a mom who loved him, but at age 13, he started smoking weed, and when he was 16, he started to use meth regularly.
Oh, no.
Yeah, big jump. No. That's a big jump. Not sure how we got here, but okay.
It's the weed. Weed is a gateway drug.
It's the devil's lettuce. Eventually, Chris dropped out of high school, and he spent his days using drugs and hanging out with the kids by the river. So,
okay, nice.
So originally, when the police called Chris and requested an interview, he thought it would be something related to his drug use. So obviously, when they're like, No, we know you use drugs, but this is about this horrific murder of a local woman. Chris was like, what?
We don't give a shit about your questionable daytime activities.
Yeah. So Chris's mother actually told him not to go and not to speak with the police because she was scared for him. And yeah. Chris told her, I have nothing to hide. I don't have any reason to not talk to the police. So he agreed to...
I am a known drug user. What do I have to lose?
Yeah. So he agreed to the interview and submitted his DNA for testing.
Okay.
So Chris was first interviewed on January 7th, 1997, and he was adamant that he had nothing to do with the murder and that he had no connection to Angie.
Okay.
But police weren't buying his story. And they decided that Chris himself, not Ben, seemed like a really good suspect.
Why? Because he does drugs?
I have no idea how we got to this point, other than they just said, this guy looks good, and here
we
go.
Well, you know, I was sitting here thinking the same thing, but only because it would be a good plot twist.
Yeah. Not because he actually fits the bill. How about the guy that raped a woman at knife point? What do I know?
Doesn't seem likely.
So they interrogated Chris for over 20 hours and subjected him to multiple polygraphs that police insisted proved he was lying to them.
Polygraphs are inadmissible in court because they are unreliable.
So fuck off. Yeah, no yeah. Thank you. And 20
but
hours?
Also, dude's a known drug user. He's probably gonna fail every poly you give him.
Yeah. I also want to say that the officer who was interrogating Chris was a cop that worked at Chris's high school. So he knew the cop and had no reason to think that this officer would be, like, leading him in the wrong direction.
And yet, in so many cases, they do. Okay. Yep. Were they, like, actually detaining him or could he have left?
I think he could have left because he's not a suspect. He's just in there for an interview. But
he probably just didn't know he could leave.
Exactly. He didn't know his rights. He didn't know what to do. He's in there thinking, well, I know this guy. There's no way he'll, like, treat me bad.
No,
and
don't do that.
He
if
does.
If you're ever being questioned by the police for any reason whatsoever and you feel uncomfortable or like you're being railroaded, you can get up and say, am I being detained or can I go?
Yes.
They have to tell you if you're free to go. And if they don't tell you that you're detained, you are free to walk out. Like, force them to arrest you.
Yeah. And if they say you're being detained, then you say, I would like my lawyer now. And you sit down and you shut up. So after a few days of interrogation, not hours, days of interrogation.
Wait. They can't keep him that long, even if he's just, like, they can't keep him that long.
They can keep him that long if he doesn't ask to leave.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Chris, leave!
Police began to threaten Chris with a death penalty and said they would give him immunity if they just told them what they wanted to know.
Isn't that coercion?
Yeah, girl. Prepare to rage.
I don't know, though, because I'm just a criminology major.
So Chris started to crack, and he began to tell the officers of the story of Angie's murder. But, like, obviously, this story was never consistent.
Okay.
So first he told the officers he could give them the name of Angie's rapist, but he went on to name several different names, including Ben Hobbs, the guy that he was, you know, apparently friends with, a man named Jeremy Sargas, and a man that was only referred to as Mike. So Ben and Jeremy's DNA was tested against the DNA collected, and they were not a match.
So why didn't they test Chris's before they, like, interrogated him for, like, days?
Let's just hold on. Do you just hold on to your horses?
Let me sit back down.
So when police learned that Bennett and Jeremy's DNA didn't match, they were pissed and insisted that Chris was lying, which, like, yeah, you've been interrogating him for days. He just wants you to leave him alone.
Yeah, seriously.
And so the previous immunity deal was contingent on Chris telling the truth the entire time. But since the DNA didn't match, they believed he was lying and the immunity deal fell through. So after several more hours of interrogations and polygraphs, Chris just eventually confessed to Angie's murder. He told police that he held Angie down while Ben Hobbs and another man named Mike raped and fatally stabbed her. He even stated to the police that he had stabbed Angie with the knife. But there's just one small problem with this. the DNA collected at the scene does not match Chris's DNA or this random Mike person or this Ben Hobbs guy. That meant that someone who was not Chris or Ben or imaginary Mike was in Angie's apartment and had assaulted her. Additionally, only one person's DNA was found at the scene, so his story is like completely off. But the DNA, yeah. I mean, but the police insisted that the DNA had just come from a different unknown person.
Okay, well, that's just not really how that works. But also, yeah. If this guy is confessing, are you giving him the food and water that he needs? And are you letting him sleep? Probably not.
No. Yeah, so the police are basically saying, we know you did this. Just because your DNA wasn't collected doesn't mean you weren't there. It just means someone else was there, and it was probably Ben Hobbs. But like,
well, the way DNA works is wherever you go, you're leaving traces of DNA. So if he was in that apartment, his DNA should have come up at some point in the investigation. But also, if you're not giving him food and water and not letting him sleep for you're coercing him, that's not even really an interrogation anymore. It's torture.
Yeah, you're just railroading someone to, like, solve this case.
And depending on the extent, maybe those officers should be brought up on charges.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are significantly hindering his human rights.
Yeah, no, agreed. So detectives move forward with this theory as if it was the truth. That multiple people committed this crime and Chris was, you know, a suspect. And they charged Chris with first-degree murder, rape, and the use of a deadly weapon in the commission of a felony. Ben Hobbs, you know, the guy who was arrested for raping a woman at knife point, was never charged in connection and denied any involvement. Which is kind of like, what? That guy's not? Okay, whatever.
Yeah, someone must have been trying to make their career.
Yeah, someone was up for re-election, I think. Speculation.
Mm-hmm.
So Angie's family, we head to trial. They're obviously relieved to finally get what they think is justice. Carol, the mom, went to trial every single day and made her presence known in the courtroom. And you just have to remember, like, she's being fed the police's agenda. So she doesn't know all this extra stuff other than the police are saying, yeah, it's him. And Carol was said to have wanted the death penalty for Chris so that he could, quote, suffer the same way her daughter had, end quote. According to C.C. Moore, who is a genetic genealogist on the case, we will talk about her more later.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris pled not guilty. And his defense was that the confession was given under manipulative tactics and he was fed lies by the detectives that were then coerced back out on tape.
Yeah.
He maintained that he had nothing to do with the murder, but in May of 1998, after 13 hours of deliberation, the jury found Chris guilty of aiding and abetting the rape and murder of Angie.
How do you get to that point?
I know, it's fucking insane. Chris was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years in prison, and at the time, police still believed that he had not acted alone, and they just didn't know who the other suspects were.
I'm sorry. This guy very obviously has not done anything, but even if he did, and it's aiding and abetting, how does that get 30 years? And literally someone who has raped a child gets like 5 or 12.
Yeah, it does.
What is the justice system? Like, what's the sentencing here?
It doesn't make sense. But luckily, this is not where the story ends. So as I said before, there's no forensic evidence to suggest that Chris was anywhere near the scene of Angie's murder, which wasn't a big deal for police, but was a huge deal for Angie's mother, Carol.
Thank you, Carol. Yes.
So, well, it started out, Carol was upset because, like, obviously someone else was responsible for the murder because we have someone else's DNA. And so she's upset that no one is making additional arrest and bringing this person to justice. So
if you're going to get justice, you want full justice.
I want all of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And so she decided to start investigating herself.
Thank you.
In 2008, 10 years after Chris's conviction, Carol asked to see the confession tapes, hoping to find some clues. So alone in her living room, Carol would watch each tape and take meticulous notes. She noted that the audio was so bad on the tapes that she had to keep replaying them over and over, and it took her more than 70 hours to get through half of a tape.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, how is that even allowed in as evidence? If your quality is so poor,
It reminded me of Darlie.
Yeah. If the audio quality is so poor, how could you even hear what he's saying?
Yeah.
You're just going off of what the cops are saying that he's saying.
And Carol herself was able to find discrepancies within Chris's story, and she realized that he didn't know much at all about what happened the night of her daughter's murder. She noted how the police pushed Chris to name his accomplices, and instead of Chris naming them directly, the police fed him names to which he concurred with. Finally, when Chris offered another name, which was this imaginary Mike, Carol was appalled when she heard it, and she said Mike was obviously, quote, an imaginary person offered up to make the investigation stop.
So she's seeing this.
Yeah.
This is the definition of a coerced confession.
Yep. Carol concluded, quote, Chris Tapp was not there. I've looked at Angie's case for 23 years, and I've been trying to put this puzzle together. The center is missing, end quote. She obviously said this after everything.
Yeah, and the fact that the mother has to do the police's work for them, that should tell you something. Do your job appropriately. Don't just try to get any conviction. Get the conviction you're supposed to get.
Yep. In 2013, after realizing Chris was innocent, she reached out to Chris's defense attorney, who was John Thomas. John had been recently assigned to the case to help with all of the appeals, and she told him she thought Chris was innocent and she was going to try to help prove it.
Good.
Carol reached out to Steve Drizin, who was the co-director of the Center of Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. Also, he's one of the nation's leading experts on false confessions.
Nice.
So Stephen noted, quote, this was the first time that a victim's mother called me and said, I've got some real concerns about the man who killed my daughter is innocent, and would you take a look at these interrogation tapes, end quote. Stephen reviewed the tapes and created the report that would later be used in Chris's appeals, and he found that Chris was threatened with the death penalty and told that he would go to the gas chamber, and that it was clearly the kind of threats that led to people giving false confessions.
The gas chamber? Was that even in use at the time?
I mean, I fucking hope not.
What? When was he interrogated? What year?
98 is when he was convicted.
Oh my God, that's a serious threat. Following the execution of Robert Alton Harris, a federal court declared that execution by lethal gas under the California Protocol is unconstitutionally cruel and unusual. So by the late 20th century, most states had switched to methods considered more humane, such as lethal injection. California's gas chamber at San Quentin State Prison was converted to an execution chamber for lethal injection. As of 2020, the last person to be executed in the gas chamber was a German national, Walter LeGrand, sentenced to death before 1992, executed in Arizona on March 3rd, 1999.
Dang, yeah, so it was a very valid threat. That's scary.
The gas chamber was formerly used in Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Oregon.
Colorado?
Six states. Arizona, California, Maryland, Mississippi, Missouri, and Wyoming authorize lethal gas if lethal injection cannot be administered.
Missouri!
In October 2010, Governor of New York David Patterson signed a bill rendering gas chambers illegal use. They're still used.
That's disgusting.
Are you kidding me? Oh my.
Personally, I think it falls under inhumane, but, you know, what do I know? That's frustrating.
I'm appalled at, like, the things we allow in the U.S.
Yeah, me too. I do want to take a pause here and talk about a part of the story that I didn't write down because it was very long and it's not extremely relevant to the case. So in, like, 2013, Carol tried to pressure the police department into using genetic genealogy to find the suspect, which at the time was like a little controversial because I do think there's valid privacy concerns, but, and basically like Idaho at the time was like, no, we don't allow that. You can't do that. But she contacted a really famous genealogist. His name was like Greg something. and she was like, hey, I want to do this. And they said no. And Greg told her, well, why don't we just look at Ancestry DNA's database? Because at the time, Ancestry DNA's database was public knowledge. And so they found a suspect whose alleles, 34 out of 35 alleles, matched with the suspect's DNA. But that man was not the suspect. And no. And so the police came, they like showed up with the warrant and they were like, hey, Ancestry, you have to give us that person's identity. They figured it out. They went to the guy. They said, okay, you have to give us a DNA swab. You're being investigated for a murder. And the dude was like, oh my fucking God, what the fuck? And then like 2 weeks later, he got this email from the police saying, oh, you're no longer a suspect. Your DNA didn't match. Sorry about it.
An email. Bitch just knocked on my door.
Yeah.
And said, you killed somebody. Come on.
Yeah.
But then you're going to be like, sorry.
Oops, our bad.
Hope we didn't cause you too much trauma. Good luck.
So the guy was actually a filmmaker, and he actually made a documentary about the whole Angie case with Carol. And the documentary started out as being like, his journey with being like not falsely convicted but like accused and them looking at him. And he actually formed a whole relationship with Carol, and instead the documentary is all about like Angie's death and Carol's search for the suspect. So I'll link that in the show notes because I can't exactly remember it, but it's a really good documentary. And then because of that, that was one of the first instances that police had ever officially, you know, provided a warrant to Ancestry and said, you have to show us this. And now Ancestry DNA's database is closed. It's not public. Which, like, that's probably a good fucking idea. What the fuck?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay, so back to where we were. So Carol and Steven contacted the Innocence Project, and John filed a post-conviction motion. In 2017, Chris and his team reached a deal with prosecutors that would vacate Chris's rape conviction, but not his murder charge.
And I just still don't understand how he got convicted of rape.
When it's not his DNA? Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah.
And Chris would then be released from prison for time served. And so Chris decided to take the deal because he was kind of like, you know, there's a chance I might never get out. So I just have to take this deal. And after spending 2 decades of his life behind bars, he was released from prison, and his biggest advocate was Carol. Even though Chris was free and, you know, very fucking innocent, in the eyes of the public, he was still a convicted murderer and hoped to one day be fully exonerated.
And you know what? And that's the thing. Like, very obviously, a jury of your peers is more like, they're more likely to convict you than anything because the public don't know shit.
Yeah.
So you're just handpicking the people that the prosecution thinks can get them an actual fucking.
Yeah, both
and
sides.
The way the jury selection works is not, like, they don't do it based on getting, like, an objective outlook from people. They do it based on who will most likely vote for a conviction.
Of course.
Which should not happen.
Yeah, it happens on both sides. Strike.
The jury is stacked against you, basically.
Yeah. So Carol continued her relentless pursuit for her daughter's killer, knowing that he was still out there, and also trying to get Chris exonerated. Fully exonerated.
And he should be. And he should be apologized to, and it should be, like, a national thing, and he should, like, get fucking money from the state.
Oh, yeah. In November 2018, Carol reached out to world-renowned genetic genealogist C.C. Moore, who had the quote we talked about earlier, and with the help of Parabon Nanotech, which I would love to work for them.
Parabon was in my case,
too. Yeah, they're like the big, they test a lot of, they're just amazing, and I want to work for them so bad, but I'm not a scientist, so, like, they don't need me.
Dang it. Can you do your paperwork?
Because I've literally, like, looked at their job openings, and all they want are scientists, and I'm like, God damn it.
I seriously wish when I was younger I wanted to pursue, like, the science route.
Oh, yeah, me
I
too,
love
yeah.
science so much now, and I hated it when I was growing
if
up.
If I could go
like,
back.
You're an idiot, Kayla. Like, good job.
So CC began working with police on the case. She started to build out a family tree of people who share DNA with the unknown suspect. And she found that two of those people intersected in one marriage that dated back to the 1800s.
Wait. Say that again.
So she's like building out this whole family tree of everyone who shared the DNA that like could be somewhat related. And she found two people that shared the DNA were married at one point. So she's like, oh, these people right here likely created the like side of the family tree that his DNA falls on.
Oh, from, okay, got it.
Yeah. Cece said, quote, I knew the suspect had to be a descendant of that marriage, so I narrowed it down to six men who were descendants of that couple, and five of the six on that list lived over 1,000 miles away and didn't have any connections to Idaho that we could find. One of them did live in Idaho. End quote.
Dang.
But don't get too excited because DNA samples were collected secretly from the man and his son, and the DNA of either one didn't match the DNA at the crime scene.
Dang.
And so even though it was a setback, Cece said that she was aware of the fact that like there could be missing descendants through divorce. And she said, quote, I knew I could not fail Carol, and Chris needs for the true killer to be found so that he can be exonerated, end quote. So Cece continued her search and found that one of the men in the family had gotten married early and then divorced. And she discovered that that marriage had created a child named Brian L. Drips Sr., who was born shortly before the couple separated. But Brian was using his stepfather's last name, Drips, so it didn't initially register within that family search tree.
Okay.
In 2019, detectives went to Caldwell, Idaho to investigate Brian. And from one of his discarded cigarettes, investigators were able to match his DNA to the semen and the hair found at the crime scene. Police also discovered that Brian had lived across the street from Angie when she was killed, and he'd moved away from the city the year of the murder.
So wait, they didn't, like, interview neighbors or anything?
No, apparently not. This guy just, like, fell through the cracks. And Brian, who was 53 years old, was arrested on May 15th, 2019, and was charged with Angie's rape and murder.
Thank you.
During the interview, Brian was confronted with the DNA evidence, and he admitted to the investigators that he was there, and he alone went into Angie Dodge's apartment and committed the crime. On June 13th, 1996, Angie had been asleep in her own apartment when Brian broke in, raped her, stabbed her, and then nearly decapitated her. At the sentencing of Brian, Judge Joel Tingey said, quote, a young man spent a significant part of his life in prison for no good reason. He was innocent. That falls on you. At the same sentencing, Carol told Brian, quote, I can't forgive you ever. You have shattered our family, and there is no way to pick up the pieces ever again, end quote. But the Dodge family also stated that there was more than one victim in the case, and the other victim was Chris. Quote, Chris Tapp should be given the opportunity to voice his nightmare to this court. He served and lost 20 years of his life because of Mr. Drips, end quote. In 2019, Chris was fully exonerated, and because of his experience, Idaho Governor Brad Little signed the Wrongful Conviction Act into law, which provided state compensation for the wrongly convicted in Idaho. And at the time, this made Idaho the 36th state to adopt a wrongful conviction compensation law.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. So when was Brian convicted?
98.
Brian.
Oh, Brian? Oh, sorry. 2019? Yeah, 2019.
Okay, so same year Chris got exonerated.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, same exact year he got exonerated.
Good. Very good.
Later in an interview, Chris said, quote, when he was released, quote, Carol was there and she was holding my hand. Her fighting for me to help get released and helping to get something better for me is part of the reason why I'm home today. I'm greatly indebted to that woman. She has no idea, end quote. John Thomas later said, who was Chris's defense attorney, quote, without Carol Dodge, Angie Dodge's murder would have gone off into the boxes upon boxes in some basement somewhere, end quote. In the years since Angie's murder, Carol and her son Brent have started the nonprofit called Five for Hope to help raise money for underfunded cold case foundations and police departments, which we will link in the show notes. It's super great. Everyone should check it out. Carol later also said that what kept her going was thinking about the last night she was able to spend with her daughter. Quote, if I hadn't had the opportunity to hold Angie in my arms that night and to tell her how much I love her, I don't know that I could have made it. It's what kept me determined to find out why my daughter was killed. And that is a story about a mother's unrelenting love for her child and the murder of Angie Dodge.
Well, I am glad that Chris is exonerated and mm-hmm. the case is actually closed. And Carol is awesome.
She is a queen. A down bitch. But yeah, I really liked researching that case. And Angie's family also has this amazing tribute to her that's very beautiful. And that's obviously linked in the show notes as well. Everyone should check that out. It's just like her mother is such a good woman. I love her so much. And yeah, to see past like the blinding hate and to be like, oh my God, like this dude is fucking innocent.
That's how the families of the victims should look at it. Like, is this a person that actually killed my family?
My baby.
That's how you should look at it. Not like, oh, you did it 100%. Because very obviously cops are not putting their energy and investigation in the right direction.
Yeah. It was a great case. I loved it. I love Carol. I loved Angie. I just love them all. So yeah, that's our episode this week.
Well, okay, remember last episode for about a month and a week.
Yeah. We gotta, you know, do adulting shit, unfortunately. Yeah,
so. Well, we'll get adjusted and we'll have some research complete and then in March.
We'll be back. All right, we'll see you guys later. Bye.
Bye.